Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Oh, hello. Welcome to Wednesday Waypoints, where Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring us lately. Or, at the very least, inspiring something. Gathered around the table this Wednesday, we've got Patrick Klepek.
Hello, hello, hello.
Austin Walker.
I'm feeling inspired.
By who?
And Natalie Watson.
I, too, am inspired.
I need to leave room for us to have a good, like, two-minute hate on something really shitty. That's the thing, like...
Okay, you know, I'm ready to hate on something.
What?
David Plotz.
David Plotz.
Oh, God.
What was yours, Natalie?
Why two?
Is it Kylie Jenner?
One is Kylie Jenner for not fucking ever eating cereal with milk until her 21st year of this earth.
I don't know how you get there. Like, I don't know how you're not just over a friend's house. Well, I guess super rich.
Yeah, but right? I don't know. I had some rich friends.
Sleepovers and, like...
And they had milk and cereal at their...
No, but I mean the other way where it's like... Maybe the rich friend is always having the sleepover.
I think she always had. She probably hosted most of the time.
There's lots of food stuff that I didn't eat when I was a kid until I was over at someone else's house and I didn't want to be rude. And I was like, yeah, I guess I'll eat whatever this bullshit is. But that was never cereal with milk.
Yeah.
See, I chose. I don't like milk in cereal. I'm not like a big milk person to begin with. Like I like
milk's good for your bones.
No, it's an ingredient in all sorts of things. I don't particularly like milk. On its own, but like I have milk in all sorts of different things that I eat, but milk by itself just doesn't do a whole lot for me. So the milk and cereal thing never quite clicked. So I just ate that cereal out of that goddamn box like an animal.
Wow. So you and Kylie?
No, but I tried it. I chose. I decided it was not for me. It is not that I had the revelation at 21. this thing.
So when Kylie does it, it's bad. Patrick, adorable quirk.
Exactly.
I chose. I don't want the milk. I'm not. This is not a revolution to me. I am choosing to not have the milk.
The other thing I hate is the PlayStation Classic.
Oh yeah, just make those games backwards compatible, right?
Yeah, it's the simplest thing. Like the thing with the NES Classic and the SNES Classic was like, okay, I don't know. It's kind of the same thing, but when it first came out, I was, like, more excited because I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
See, when Nintendo does it, adorable. Sony, evil cash grab.
I'm trying to figure out what do people have, what's the problem they have with the, I mean, I'm not going to buy any of these things, but, like, what's the difference?
I already pre-ordered it.
Yo,
is this a two-minute hate on yourself, then? Is this a self-loathing thing?
Well, I mean, there's always an element of that. I got it as a gift for someone else.
Yeah, okay.
Are they your roommate? Is this where you buy a gift for someone else, but you're buying it for yourself?
I bought it for my boyfriend, so it's...
So yes.
Basically. So you're sitting here on this podcast saying, this is bullshit, but you're conveniently buying it in a way that you can use it.
But I am being transparent.
If you were really going to walk the walk, you would be on eBay finding a launch backwards compatible PS3 right now, this moment.
That's that truth.
I've honestly been thinking about getting a PS3.
Okay, well...
You know what? I've got one because I'm like, there's still a lot of good stuff there. It's hooked up. I haven't turned it on in months.
Really don't want a PS Now. I want a PS3.
You want to actually play games.
Yeah, I don't want to PS Now. Anyway.
My brain's very mixed up in my head right now.
Those are all of my thoughts.
That's a lot of things to hate. On this podcast about things that inspire us.
Okay.
I guess hate is a
Look,
sort
Wednesday
of inspiration.
Waypoints, work in progress.
Yeah.
We're figuring it out.
Just like us.
Here's what I love. We had one chance to do this show for the first time, and this is how we kicked it off.
Cereal.
I'm so sorry.
No, I'm happy.
Okay.
Fuck David Plotz. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Who's that?
Oh, my God.
We can't.
Okay. Well, speaking of that, though, like, I know it's been a week, and maybe this isn't the best thing to transition into, but I need to talk to you guys
about
fascist propaganda.
Okay.
All right, good. David Plotz.
What is it? What is the fascist propaganda of choice today?
So I went to I was at the MFA in Boston. They've got this exhibit, The Art of Influence, which is a collection of postcards, propaganda postcards from like World War I and World War II eras. And it's kind of just an interesting artifact in that, like, oh, yeah, the Postal Service was in some ways fulfilling the same purpose of, like, social media today, right? It's like you'd send people little postcards for propagandistic purposes, also just as a way of saying hi. Like, hey, look at this cool fascist pocket-sized fascist poster I found. I think you guys really like it.
Sick.
And you'd send that, yeah. So they got the collection of all this stuff, and it's really interesting because there's really, like, distinctive patterns and tropes between the different belligerents. Like, it is really striking how bad the German propaganda is, like, almost universally.
When you say bad here, do you mean in quality?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like... Like, look, 95% of the stuff there is bad, like, morally, politically speaking. Oh, yeah, like, it's,
yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's mostly bad shit. But, like, the German stuff is just awful. Like, I sent you guys an example of, like, a World War I era German, like, propaganda, like, campaign. This was, like, a recurring motif in World War I where they're showing, like... British caricatures with big mouths. Guys, just like
I'm very curious about big mouth.
1916.
And the joke is, they're like, here's the British 300mm mortar. Ha ha! It's a guy with a big mouth. Because the joke is that the Germans have real 210mm artillery, and the British don't. All they got is
some big mouths.
Some big mouths.
And there's like a dozen of these things. Like, that was such a fucking knee slapper that, like,
got
the
guys.
It's so bad.
But I mean, like, that reflects so much of the ideologies going into World War I, right? Which is a bunch of imperial powers looking to flex their muscles and, like, determine who is the leading power in Europe because of technological advancement. And, like, I guess they didn't invest in propaganda and humor, but they did invest in big guns.
Yeah, it's – but if you look at what the other belligerents are doing, like the Russian and – the Russian stuff tends to be really sentimental. Mm. The Russian stuff is all very defending the homestead in some ways. Like I don't know. I didn't take too many photos of it because it wasn't as like – It wasn't as striking because it was mostly kind of unobjectionable in a lot of ways. Lots of pictures of, you know, soldiers departing for the front, you know, farms, somewhere on the Eurasian plain. But like, they are doing different things. The British are doing different things, but the Germans have this. The other thing they've got, the other motif they return to a lot, is a weird fixation on Britain as an island, like. It's amazing the degree to which German propaganda is just like a record of their psychological frustrations at not being able to cross the channel.
A tiny island nation beset by constant rain. Note the umbrellas. And then like this man holding an umbrella gripping his ass, like barely making it through the water. It's very strange. The English disease is the name of that piece.
Right. Well, like, I guess part of that speaks to something larger that I think maybe we don't often think about is – I think when you say the word propaganda, what we think of is, like, a handful of images. It is, like, racist Nazi propaganda. It is Rosie the Riveter.
Yeah.
It is, like, Uncle Sam saying, you know, I need you. Mm-hmm. It is keep calm and carry on, mm-hmm. which was not actually deployed in the way that I think we historically
have. It was found in a basement after the war, right?
Yeah.
It was like conceptualized but not ever actually used and then just became popular.
Or, or if it was used, it was not used en masse. It was not like everywhere in England during the war.
Unlike now, where it is everywhere on people's phone cases.
Yeah, exactly. but when we think about propaganda, like propaganda can be those different things. It can be a postcard of the beautiful Russian steppe, because what's trying to be produced is a certain sentimentality of motherland, mm-hmm. of home, of oh, this is the place that unites us or whatever. Or it could be
– This is what we're fighting for.
Right. Or it could be a racist diss that like dehumanizes the targets of action that in your you know, I don't even say rational mind, but targets of dehumanization who on another day you may in fact wish to defend. It helps reproduce them as something less than human so that the acts taken against them are easier to overlook or even root for and aid along. Or you could make fun of the fact that England is an island and it's rainy.
Better bring an umbrella. Yuck, 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 yuck.
What was fascinating to me though, Rob, was the Italian stuff that you also singled out.
Yeah, that was the stuff that really jumped out at me, because it is far and away the most like aesthetically accomplished stuff in that exhibit. And that's not actually a huge surprise. Like if you look at the origins of Italian fascism, totally like bound up within movements in Italy's artistic community.
Right.
Like Italian fascism is intertwined in a way that like a lot of political movements that era were not, with sort of the political and artistic ferment of the moment. And that goes back to World War One. Italy's slide into fascism really begins during World War One. If anyone's curious, like there's this excellent book called The White War, which is about Italy's campaign in the Alps against the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But one of the central tenets of this book is like, Italy goes into that war as a young country and kind of a fractious one, but like a pretty normal one still. It's recognizably like a liberal democracy in a lot of ways. And over the course of that war, they basically like start plunging into fascism, and they never quite escape. And a lot of their art is tied up in that. And that combines with the Futurist movement, which Italian artists were really leaders of. And that is immediately appropriated by the fascists, and not even just appropriated, like to a degree, they're also fostering it. They're encouraging it. And so in the interwar years, in the 30s, Italian fascist propaganda, at least a lot of it, is really aesthetically like captivating. Like they are making like striking futurist images. I hesitate to say like this is cool shit, but like some of the stuff, like 1931, there's no war being fought yet. I don't think they've even invaded Ethiopia by then. But they're celebrating their air force. But the posters for it are all of these like polygonal studies and like the idea of aircraft. It looks like the sort of thing that you'd see at a World's Fair poster, and it's all really impressive and striking, and that's Italy like when things are going well. The really funny thing is the stuff from the late war, that motif dies out, and it's hilarious. Like the Italian propaganda, once they start losing all that coolness, all that like look to the skies for the powerful air force, we strike at our enemies from above, all that goes out the window because they're getting the shit bombed out of them like daily.
Right.
And they're being invaded.
Right.
And suddenly the propaganda shifts. And I think I sent you guys a picture of this caricature of Roosevelt and Churchill. Also looking weirdly kind of cool, like badass, like ghost gangsters.
This is like hovering. A Frank Miller comic cover or something. Like, I think I've seen this Sin City.
Some sort of alt history.
Is one of them brandishing a semi-automatic pistol?
Both of them are. They both just have pistols in their hands.
And they clearly have both been fired. There's smoke emanating from like the end of the gun. Like some shit has gone down and they came out all right.
Yeah, and like it's this like bombed out Italian city and like tons of dead civilians in the streets. And that was the propaganda move. It was this, you know, really, the cost of modern war is inhumane. It's terrible that anyone would do this. Who would dare?
Right. Right. Well, again, I think that there's two things there that I think are worth digging into. One is the ways in which aesthetics can both help shape a politics and also how aesthetics are shaped by politics, and how the second they needed to ditch the futurism and the and you know, move into this kind of like more traditional caricature, they could. But the other thing is there's this – you said like, oh, it looks cool. And part of the reason why it looks cool is we've seen it used, and the descendants of this of the Italian futurists used constantly to create cool looking things, right? Like, yeah. Art Deco as a movement,
exactly.
Is grown out of the futurist movement, in part at least. But also – like the thing that you said of like, oh yeah, the fascists, you know, used futurism, but actually the Italian futurists loved fascism. Like they were not just on board with it, not just like, oh yeah, we're along for the ride, but like it was aligned with their philosophical ends of industrializing the country. And that's partly why they didn't really love a lot of the rest of fascist art in a weird way, right? Like the Nazi art is not at all like futurism. In fact, when I look at futurism, not just me, when you look at futurism, it looks like the sorts of art that Hitler would say was degenerate art, because it was not purely representational. It was not about showing like the strength of the state or the strength of mankind in clean, simple ways. Mm-hmm. And yet – fascism, as always, will arbitrarily find an excuse.
Well, I was just going to say, like, yeah, so you look at the Italians, what they're doing with, like, this cool futurist art. I sent everyone a picture of some pre-war Nazi propaganda.
Right.
And what are they doing at this time? It's a cartoon where Ghost Frederick the Great, Bismarck, and Adolf Hitler are, like, huddling up. And, like, they're about to do the whole, like, break thing. That's their propaganda message, and it's again like just terrible trash.
Right.
But it is striking the degree to which, like, you're right, Austin, the tradition that the Nazi propaganda is operating in is very much this like hearkening back to classic themes. It's all very little literal representation, very little left to the imagination.
And yeah. The futurists were always like this, right? Filippo Marinetti, who is like one of the key Italian futurists, explicitly like was not just a backer of the Italian war in Ethiopia, but like wrote about how it was in line with the Italian futurist aesthetic like movement. Like he said, "War is beautiful." War is beautiful because thanks to its gas masks, its terrifying megaphones, its flamethrowers and light tanks, it establishes man's dominion over the subjugated machine. War is beautiful because it inaugurates the dreamed of metallization of the human body. War is beautiful because it enriches a flowering meadow with the fiery orchids of machine guns. And this goes on and on and on. And it's just like, these are people who have given themselves over to the idea of industrialization and have found a sort of like – I think maybe this is why it's a fascist movement, is at its heart is still this nationalism, but also this idea of man's power, of humankind – of man, not humankind, please, of man over nature and over – even over the machines that they are using to expand their empires.
And even to replace.
Right.
Like that nature – to become non-existent.
Right. Exactly.
Like it is not like control of that nature. It is not like bioengineering. It is like
a
metal planet. Yeah, exactly.
A metal planet. We're going to get to metal in a little bit. Mandy's later. We're going to talk about metal later.
I have thoughts.
But I guess, Rob, my question for you is like, and also these are postcards you got that people sent around, which is such a mundane little thing.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing. It's hard to imagine. Like, I really do wonder how prevalent these things were as – like, this is a collection that's obviously collected in part because they're like, it's a historical curiosity. It's drawn from a much larger collection of postcards from the 1800s and 1900s. But I really do wonder, to what degree were people really, like, out – like shopping, like you're standing at the counter, like buying a candy bar, and you look over and you see like, oh, hey, cool. Like Bismarck and Frederick the Great are bros with Hitler. Yeah, man. Hans will get a kick out of that.
Send that over.
Yeah. I really do wonder about that. But I think one of the things that I think was really striking to me is just the degree to which when everything was going well, fascist art is like explicitly instrumentalized on behalf of power. Even if the even if power and violence isn't explicit in these themes, like, the capacity for it, it is always there. Like, fascist art is kind of marveling at the idea of capacity for power and violence. And it's really, like, kind of excited, gleeful at the thought of what you could, who you could turn it against, right? This is partly, like, why the fixation on England is interesting. England is an island. It's the one country that Germany can't easily bully. You can't just walk over there and kick the shit out of them because there's the English Channel. And that really clearly got under the German skin. And that's why you see a lot of, like, celebratory postcards in World War II about, like, ha, they'll never expect our Luftwaffe, which didn't work out. It was striking to me the degree to which, like, these themes repeat through history. Like, when that power, when the fascist power is being broken or turned against them, suddenly they're all about empathy. Suddenly they are victims, and humanity comes rushing to the forefront because they can no longer appeal to, like, you know, to just raw power.
Right.
And they begin making a case for moral restraint.
Is the modern, like, fascist postcard alt-right meme pages on Facebook?
I mean, or is it like Fox News to a certain degree, right? Like, Fox News, especially in, you know, in the Obama era, it was reactionary. In the Trump era, it is, you know, by and large, state-run propaganda when you you know, folks like Sean Hannity, you know, referred to as a shadow chief of staff talking with the president every night, you know, a president with, you know, fascist tendencies or at least fascist curious. It's, I mean, Fox News seems like the closest equivalent we have to sort of like a modern propaganda machine. That I wonder how that cycle works, or Rob, how you look at that, how Fox News operates and how that cycle could play out depending on where that presidency goes.
But I think, like, Fox News is a very traditional top-down propaganda outfit. In a lot of ways, like, Hannity is not quite as all-encompassing as, like, a Joseph Goebbels, but, like, it's a figure like that. They sort of parallel each other a little bit. I think the meme pages thing, I think the postcard and meme pages comparison is maybe just a little more apt, because if you think about, like, again, the idea of how these things are shared, it's meant to be sort of the self-reinforcing phenomenon of, like, funny. And in the case of, like, a lot of alt-right propaganda, a lot of it is meant to be these small messages that carry a lot of meaning and context. They're densely packed with a lot of, like, self-referential material. And part of the appeal, I think, is you already kind of get it. You're kind of bought in. So somebody, you know, I don't know, somebody sends you a picture of, like, Pepe laughing at a crying Hillary or something. And, like, that is a message. That's something that, like, is going to get shared around.
It means nothing to someone, but it means something to the people who get it. They understand immediately the messaging. The other person is like, what is this shitty frog?
Yeah.
In this,
and it relies on paint image. The grassroots passing it around amongst themselves. It's like endlessly self-pollinating.
Well, and there's also, like, a deferred meaning to some degree, right? Like, in that, like, they could never explain the joke to you, because the joke is fuck Hillary, fuck snowflakes, etc. Like, it doesn't actually have a punchline outside of its, like, outside of who the target is and who it would upset if they did understand, right? Like, it isn't like it's not a political cartoon in the sense that, like, oh, Pepe is the oil industry, right?
Or in explaining the image falls apart. Because what it's trying to communicate is an emotional gut reaction based on, like, a long history of inferences and, like, things you picked up, as opposed to, like you're saying,
which does the thing,
having a message.
Which does the thing that fascism does, which is it creates – and, like, you can look at – for me, this is, like, the way Umberto Eco just describes fascism in Ur-Fascism, or the way some of the Frankfurt School people do, which is that it creates a sort of, like, it devastates the individual. It completely destroys the individual and instead creates a sort of monolithic national identity that the person takes as their individual identity. And, like, aha, this is us. We are the ones who laugh at Pepe. We are the ones who like, all go to the same, like, alt-right meme page. And that creates the identity. Though I think Patrick also is getting to something really important with the Fox News thing, which is there is something distinct between, like, mid-century World War II era and even post-World War II era propaganda going into Vietnam. Or I think maybe that is where the switch happens one of the pivots happens, which is propaganda stops just being state-run and often becomes corporatized, often becomes individualized. It is in advertisements. It is in it becomes a lot more nebulous because it's about the production of what it means to be an American. But that as often happens through U.S. Army commercials as it does Gatorade ads.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just like it becomes this thing that's like it's not let's go to war. It's hey, this is fine. Everything is fine. Don't go on strike. Don't march in the streets. Don't ask us what's up with the weird – with why your soda tastes different now. Don't worry about the fact that we moved the factories. And don't worry about the fact that we're using slave labor overseas and that we don't really even know that for sure. But it probably is happening.
Yeah.
And just like stay calm.
But we're an American company.
Right.
And to be an American consumer is to consume American products.
That's right.
So –
this is one of the central tenets of Jacques Ellul's propaganda, which he's making the argument. He begins it as a study of like classic like top-down propaganda efforts, but he points out that like, oh yeah, free Western societies, particularly the U.S., are like among the most relentlessly propagandized in history. But it's all done on behalf of companies and advertising. Like he's like advertising's first purpose is to assure people that everything in the social order is fine. And selling you is actually the second. Like this is the second order. Of priority.
Well, but, that's like the flip of like the alt-right memes and Fox News is actually not that everything's fine, but is a like perpetual state of victimhood that you are under assault despite the fact that, you know, in many ways conservatives hold like all sorts of levels of power.
Exactly.
There's like, always a Churchill and Roosevelt floating over your shitty city.
It might be Hillary. Guns. It might be, but yep.
Uh-huh, right, but even now, when like Democrats hold like so very little actual like actionable power to change the lives of people from the Supreme Court to the presidency on down, and yet all the propaganda on the right is on stoking perpetual victimhood that they're coming for your X, Y, and Z.
But also that they're weak. You're stronger than them because
it's almost like you're
enduring.
The alt-right memes are like the more like aggressors, right? It's about like propping up like Donald Trump is like an aggressor, like it's punching back. And Fox News is about like, well, we're weak. We're actually like we have no power. Like you actually everything is coming for you. Like you are a weak person. And like the alt-right stuff is like more along the lines of like the weird strength aggression.
Yeah, but there's still like the feel when no girlfriend. I don't know. There's like all there that.
Gamergate, right? Like, I mean, Gamergate was a huge propagandist, movement in which it was built on the idea of victimhood that folks like all these people in this call were coming for your video games.
And we did, and there's
and
no
we
more
are.
Hell
games.
Yeah!
The only one left is the PS1.
PlayStation Classic canceled.
All right, last thing I'm going to say about this.
Cereal milk canceled.
Last thing I'm going to say about this, in all the art I saw, it was still, like, Ben Garrison still couldn't have gotten a job illustrating these fucking postcards. All right, so I think talking about, like, violence, though, and power and victimhood. Natalie is, I understand it, you've been engaging with art that is maybe less explicit in its meanings, in its intent, but really, like from what I've seen, because I'm also watching it for the first time, intensely concerned with violence and its targets and who holds power.
Absolutely. I'm watching Twin Peaks, y'all, for
hell
the first time ever. My first, actually, I was gonna say it was my first David Lynch thing, but I did watch Mulholland Drive in a senior high school critical theory class.
Wild.
In which I fell asleep. So I don't really remember what went down in that movie. I remember it was mad weird.
A lot of people saw that movie that don't remember what went down in that movie. So
yeah, staying awake is not necessarily a part of understanding.
Yeah, I kind of got that gist. I'm watching Twin Peaks for the first time. And that show, I have so many questions.
Wait, the way you were explaining, I'm curious, you were explaining when you watched it that you know, how much do you understand, like, did you know about Twin Peaks going into it, other than it's David Lynch, it's weird, like, because for, I think folks like, for like me, when I watched it before Twin Peaks The Return, which I didn't get around to, I had so much cultural osmosis about the memification of Twin Peaks, and it's both in terms of what people have done with that series, and then also it's how it's impacted culture in ways like obvious and not so obvious. And because how much of that you were aware of before, like I knew who the log lady was, which like made like characters like that like far less like fun to discover. And so I'm curious what your what your history with it was going into it.
Like none. Okay, like zero
that's
history.
That's so good. That's so much better.
That's amazing. It's like, okay.
Yeah, I know nothing. I truly don't know anything. The only thing I knew was like the music.
Okay.
Like some of the, like the first, well, because, okay, so my boyfriend is like a huge David Lynch fan, and he often will, he has like a Twin Peaks playlist that he like likes to play during the day.
Oh my God, that would drive me fucking insane.
But it's funny because that music is like, exactly, it's like mad romantic to me.
Just that making music, your coffee, boom.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's live that life.
That music is like now, well, not because of my boyfriend, but like maybe it is a little bit because of him, but it like has like a very romantic like feeling, or I have like a very romantic feeling associated with it. So when I hear it in the show, like I always like feel this sort of like there's like a sentimentality being like brought forward for me, or there's some sort of like, anyway, I think it's the most artistic soap opera I've ever watched.
Natalie has left the microphone. Oh,
just to plug in my computer. Sorry, because okay. It's about to die. I am on episode 5 of the first season right now. I've been like kind of binging it and trying to watch as much as I can, mostly because I want the answers.
Yep. Keep watching.
But it's funny because it's not like a thing where I'm like getting distracted by the questions, which I think is something that can be a problem with sort of the more open-ended, like, ooh, what's happening here? Like Westworld for me. I watched a couple episodes and I had so many questions and there were so many like holes left that it was just kind of distracting for me. And I wanted to know that world, without having to like guess at it. Like I just wanted like the
right.
world to be presented to me.
You need the puzzle box.
Exactly. But with, what's interesting about the way that Twin Peaks is presented is that it is a very, when I say so, like it has a soap opera structure, like very much in terms of like the plot line. Like that's a plot line you could find in a soap opera. And because of that, like even if I'm anticipating the wrong thing, even if I'm anticipating the wrong answers,
what? Huh?
My computer started making noise because I was looking at it.
Are you thinking
Lynch
about
interview.
The swing dance? Was
no,
that like the swing
not what
dance?
That was just an appetizer.
Oh, okay. Oh.
I want to see him laugh and not answer it. Yeah.
That's what it was. That is literally what I was looking at.
But because I'm anticipating, and even if those anticipations are wrong, at least like I don't. There's nothing like nagging at. I mean, there is a lot nagging.
I was
going to
say there must be. I mean, by episode 5, you're starting to get into some real questions.
Some of the surrealism.
Yeah.
Love that shit.
I'm only up to episode 2, and right now it's still a very traditional.
Ever? So, Rob, you've not seen this show either.
No, I was inspired. Like I was like, oh, Natalie's going to bring it up, and you know what? Now's the time.
Rob, want to start a Twin Peaks rewatch podcast?
But it would have to be like, it would have to do something that Isle Thumbs didn't already cover.
Yeah.
That would be the issue for me.
Yeah,
but like, it can be recurring at like Waypoint.
Yeah. You get to a good Twin Peaks episode, we can talk about it whenever you want.
Okay, cool.
But, give me any excuse.
Because right now, though, for me, it's still very much, and this is striking to me, the degree to which so many shows are completely straight-faced adaptations of this to a degree. Like, Twin Peaks is, I'm not sure I can think of many shows like it before Twin Peaks exists, where it's the murder in a small town, an entire, like, it's not a case of the week. The entire TV show is structured around like one crime, and it's like rippling effects through this community and what led to it. And it's a show that is like interrogating the inner workings and connections of a community. And I'm thinking, like, now that that genre is very popular, like, but it's all very straight-faced as well. Like, Broadchurch is a great example. But Broadchurch isn't trying to be surreal, right? Broadchurch is just murder in a small town. Let's ferret out every mystery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Twin Peaks is interesting because, like, I feel like, and I'm not sure where this is going, but already in the early episodes, the Dale Cooper character, he's like a brilliant detective, but it's also clear he's somebody who's like obsessed with the idea that there are connections between things. That,
oh, yeah.
Like, there's larger context and meaning to everything. It's not just that somebody sent you to a decent hotel they knew about. It's that they picked out the best hotel for you, and that makes it special.
Yeah.
Everything is like, it's a throwaway gag, but I don't think it's a joke. Early on where he's like, he's got his little dictaphone and he's like, who killed JFK? And, but that's who he is. Like,
yeah.
Everything is like, he is that guy, as normal as he seems. He doesn't seem that normal. He's always the guy with the red twine, like, evidence collages on the wall, whether they're there or not.
Yeah. But in a way that is very much like, it's less like cause and effect and more like the workings of the universe, if that makes sense. Like, there, he has like, because there, he has a deep sort of spirituality to the way that he approaches these connections. Like, they're not just cause and effect. They have like you're saying, like, deeper context. Like, they're more spread out, and thus like deeper associations, which are unraveled throughout at least the first five episodes that I've been watching.
Keep on going.
Yeah, so I think that Agent Cooper is someone really fascinating for me. And I think my favorite character right now is Lucy. Every time Lucy's, like, there, it makes me... She's always kind of connected within... She's, like, very necessary, and she, like, operates in the space of, like, the police, the sheriff, and all of them in a way that is, like, taken seriously. Like, she is, I don't know how to articulate. It's hard because I'm so...
You're in it.
I'm in it, but yeah. I also, like, there's just so much... There's also, like, a lot I could talk about now, but I don't want to spoil for Rob.
Sure.
I don't want to spoil it.
No, yeah, don't.
You should go in.
No.
Completely.
The
fresh.
Less you know, the better, because that is such a...
Uh-huh.
I knew way too much going into watching the show, like, that it just took away from so much of it.
You, Patrick, like me, probably came in with the cultural knowledge of having seen Simpsons episodes that reference certain locations and characters and other parodies and other, like, set, like, there's...
Or just the amount of, like, puzzle box shows I watched that, and, like, only exist because of Twin Peaks, and then thus are full of referential material, that watching Twin Peaks was interesting. I mean, I really enjoyed the show. Like, it holds up, like, regardless of how much... You could read Wikipedia summaries of every episode, and it is still a tremendous show to watch. But some of the impact, some of the joy of the discovery was taken away because I came to it in a way that the culture had already permeated so much of what I knew in advance.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
To get to your point really quick on Lucy, though, I do think, and to shout out the Idle Thumbs Twin Peaks Rewatch podcast, Twin Peaks has such weird gender politics in that women are perpetually victimized in that show. It opens with the death of a young woman. Let me tell you, women continue to be on the end of violence in that show.
Yeah.
Tend to be hurt by men.
Mm-hmm.
Men continue to hurt women in that show is actually what I want to say.
Yeah.
But also, and again, Chris Remo and Jake Rodkin over on the Idle Thumbs Twin Peaks Rewatch podcast pointed out that for the first two seasons of that show, at least, women are hyper-competent in the city of Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks only functions because of the women of Twin Peaks, who are constantly cleaning up the fucking messes of the dopey, shitty dudes.
Yeah.
And constantly doing the emotional labor of, like, making them feel like they're not complete fuck-ups, even when they're complete fuck-ups.
Yeah.
Operating the institutions that Twin Peaks needs to like run by, like, that, like, you, this is what you're kind of getting at with Lucy, right? Is like,
yeah, Shout and Norma with the R&R.
Right, 100%.
Yeah.
100%, which is seen as like the heart of the town,
yeah,
in a sense.
It's like the hub.
And that is super fascinating given the thing that you started with, which is it's a soap opera. It's like a really cool soap opera.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that stuff has always worked for me pretty well.
Yeah.
It's also a show that I enjoy. So when you were talking, Natalie, about, you know, what you're curious about and you're curious what the show will or won't address and expand upon, what I love about Twin Peaks is its indifference to, like, that aspect of its own. Like, it is both obsessed and indifferent to its own mythology, which is such an interesting approach for a show because the takeaway from so many shows that came after that used Twin Peaks as like their foundational text was to be obsessed with their mythology, but also obsessed with those answers.
Yeah.
And what Twin Peaks realized was that the tension you can have with an audience is both providing and not providing answers, but the way it presents itself as a sort of creative ethos is indifference. It's like Twin Peaks just is. Like, it is as a place, it is as a creative work, and that frustration you have with the word, well, not frustration is even the wrong word, but that tension, I guess, is the more accurate, like, is part of what makes it special. Like, and it's a lot of what a lot of shows afterwards really didn't quite grasp. Like, it's, you know, if you look at, you know, the sort of, you know, modern puzzle box show of Lost, right? Like, that was a show that was not indifferent to answers. Like, it unfolded the puzzle box really interestingly, but the answers themselves, like, it provided a lot more answers than people give that show credit for. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, the answers weren't that interesting because the questions it was asking were the interesting part. And that it didn't realize that actually what it should have done was leave more ambiguity. And you take Damon Lindelof, who was one of the co-creators of that show, the show he made after that, The Leftovers, is a response to Lost and the creative response to that show and the audience response is that The Leftovers opens with a significant portion of the planet just disappearing in the blink of an eye in sort of a cataclysmic event, and everyone's left behind. And the show never answers why. And the show is upfront about saying, we are indifferent to what happened. We're just going to deal with the fact that it did. And Twin Peaks is very like, things just happen. That's just, it just happened. You don't need to know why the curtain was opened. The curtain just opened. And that's just a really interesting way to approach storytelling. That not a lot of shows have the courage for because they, especially in an age of Reddit and YouTube analysis, like there's this desire, and this is what Westworld gets wrong, even as a show that I like in certain respects, is the way that Westworld was written. Like, we want you to
be solved.
This. The answers are there. It undercuts so much of the parts that I do like about that show because it is so obsessed with the answer portion.
Yeah. And I think that indifference is shared by, or is at least like mimicked for you in the show itself. Like when the sheriffs all walk in and the agent walks in and, you know, the moose head is like on the table and they're like, why is the moose head on the table? And he's like, oh, fell. And that's it. You know? And
fell
like,
from where?
Sure. Like, I don't know. Maybe it was like on the wall and then it fell.
Yeah.
And then they put it on the table to put it back up. Like, that's perfectly logical.
Yeah. And that, it doesn't have to be.
It doesn't. When you're in the school for one of the first times, and the kid is like,
you're doing like a dance thing. You're like, doing like a weird.
He's like, and he dips out for no reason. Like, cool kids. I don't know.
Kids
like,
dip sometimes.
Kids dip.
Kids dip. Kids are known to dip.
But it's like, those kind of little quirks or those little moments, they're not, because they're not fixated on in the show by anyone in the space.
Right. No one is like, why did that kid dip?
Yeah.
Because if they did, everyone who's watching would be like, all right, the dipping kid. We have to figure out what's up with the dipping kid.
Here's my 30-minute analysis of the dipping kid. Now, granted, that video probably still exists.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that's definitely an
out. But the work doesn't invite that in the same way because it is structured in a very specific way.
Here's what I would say is, like, as someone who's seen everything there is in Twin Peaks, I haven't read the books. I haven't read, like, the secret diary of Laura Palmer or, like, this dossiers of whatever, blah, blah, blah.
Is that all David Lynch certified?
No. So, like,
Mark
the thing
Frost, right?
Yeah. So here's the – there's a couple things people. To know. Well, it's a bunch of people because it's a TV show and a million people make it. Also, it's worth saying that specifically because you can really start to feel the touch of different directors and writers as the show continues. Mm-hmm. The second season, there's a point at which David Lynch and Mark Frost kind of take their hands off the rudders and let a different team, creative team, take the lead. And it is a very straight – it leans so – I mean, it's already a soap opera. It is a soap opera, good and bad. But it leans really hard on some qualities of American soap opera storytelling that are just like rough. The acting gets worse because the direction isn't as good and the cinematography isn't as compelling. And it's just – it gets rough in the middle of season two. But there's a lot of people who touch that show. And of the two leads, of David Lynch and Mark Frost – there is a divide in what they're interested in a real way. And one of my favorite things about Twin Peaks as a property are the ways in which you can be like, aha, this is Mark Frost, where it's about the kind of like the weird conspiracy side, the stuff that ends up happening with different agencies and with different connections between, you know, the history of the, you know, not the ancient history of Twin Peaks, but the history of an earlier Twin Peaks, right. Blah, blah, blah. And the David Lynch stuff tends to be more weird and it's about producing an emotional reaction and a feeling of often revulsion. Mm-hmm. And there are times when you can almost feel the two fighting in their works. You haven't seen Fire Walk With Me, but Fire Walk With Me in parts feels like a direct response to the kind of twee quaintness of Mark Frost's Twin Peaks. There are parts in Twin Peaks The Return, which I will not get into at all, but that feel like an entire response to Twin Peaks as a whole work, that it feels like Mark Frost and David Lynch sat down and were like picking at their own stuff until it became something a little bit different. And I love that quality about the show. And I also think one of the things that makes it different than – we do get the 30-minute what's the secret of blah, blah, blah video for Twin Peaks. But what I see more of is how is this about the reaction to abuse? Mm-hmm. How is this – what is the show saying about empathy and the dangers of empathy or the positives of empathy? What does this say about, you know, American exceptionalism or the feeling of the American like small town Main Street America? What are David Lynch and Mark Frost and the creative team of Twin Peaks trying to communicate about cities and towns in America where everything looks so pristine and perfect?
Yeah, the insular.
Exactly. Like great coffee. Dead girl on the ground. Yeah. Right.
Best pie.
But the best pie. But also, what's happening at that
One Eyed Jacks.
At One Eyed Jacks or at the
mill.
The mill at the sawmill. And that stuff does end up being the center point of what a lot of the fan communication is about. But then also there is still a little bit of the like, well, what does this mean? What does that mean? But that ends up dripping down into a larger conversation because there isn't the key to unlock it all. And that's part of why I love it.
Yeah. The what does it mean is more like a fun thing to do. Like the little weird – like that it's like less consequential.
Right.
And so that is kind of – interesting to be more imaginative with that, to be more creative and to have a little bit more like audience interpretation there. But for the things that you're talking about in terms of like as a representation of a story of abuse or reactions to.
It's very much a show about the abuse that happens in plain sight that nobody like this is a show where nobody fucking listens. Nobody pays attention to particularly like what women are saying and showing and going through. And I think there's a point early where, like, might be James says something to the effect of, like, oh, they won't understand because, you know, they didn't know her like I did.
Like I knew her.
Yeah. And the answer is, like, everyone thinks they know in this series, but, like, nobody knows. And that allows so much to be perpetuated.
What's so disturbing about that, I think, is – and this is – one or two episodes ahead of you, Rob, but Laura has like a lot of secrets, and the fact that they are dispersed. Well, I guess it's not, but this is kind of the fact of the show. The secrets are dispersed across, like, all these different people, right? And there's a scene at the funeral, Laura Palmer's funeral, where Bobby is like, we all fucking knew.
Yeah.
Like, everyone had a tiny piece of that something was wrong, and nobody did anything. Yep. And that's super disturbing. And it's also disturbing that this is, like, I don't know, that they're, that, like, I have this, like, strange vision of Laura where they're, where she's isolated and isn't calling for
that was weird, right?
I just want to say, the pause went on long enough that we have to acknowledge the weird pause.
Did you hear it?
What? Did you hear that?
I heard kind of a rumble, maybe.
Yeah, there was suddenly a very strange sound.
It was like, and I was like, oh,
we might be.
Fuck.
Yeah, I think we
she
may
here?
Have, we may have just crossed over into another world. I don't know.
We're in the dreamscape.
Jesus.
But what I was going to say is that I have, like, these two kind of conceptions of Laura from when she was alive. And one is that she was extremely isolated and, like, isolated her. I think this is, like, what the sort of show first presents, is that she was, like, isolated, wasn't talking, had a lot of secrets, and, like, had this, like, private life. And that's why, you know, nobody knew. But the fact is that these secrets were, like, deposited in all these different little places. And any one of these things was a sign that, something is very, very wrong.
You didn't need it all to know.
You didn't need it all. You could have had one piece to be like, okay, something is off here.
Just last thing. I couldn't, like, with the music, I just made this note the other day, about what was driving me nuts about it was, I called it, all the music sounds like a glissandirge, is kind of how it sounds. Like, it is, I think that's the romantic quality of it, but it is, slowly, like, the artistic soap opera theme is something I think I'll want to revisit, because I am not sure the degree to which it is intentionally, like, evoking soap opera conventions and sound and look versus, like, look, this is 90s TV. And, like, you know, you put a 90s TV crew on something, this is what you're going to get, even with David Lynch.
I mean, this aired on ABC, right? Like, and this also, what's weird to, it's interesting to read up on the history of the show. Like, this was back in a time when still everyone watched, like, a popular show was a show that everybody watched. And Twin Peaks, especially now where, like, David Lynch is like, oh, he's like that quirky director who makes, like, you know, small culty movies. Like, Twin Peaks was a phenomenon. Like, the first season was, like, a kind of show that everybody was watching. And to look at it now as a cultural artifact and how strange it feels and how odd and, like, the little flourish, like, you know, the boy dancing and, like, the other stuff like that. Like, you wouldn't see that in a show. Like, this was a show that, like, tens of millions of people were watching, were, like, on the edge of their seats to find out what happened to Laura Palmer, and are probably ignoring all these, like, Lynchian quirks along the edges. And it'll be interesting when both of you get to season two, because a lot of where it gets strange is because, you know, the first season is, what, 10 episodes? Something like that? It's a pretty short order. And the second season is 22.
Shit.
Oh, that's always where things go wrong.
Yeah. Well, it was a result of the cultural response, the commercial response to the show, which was, hey, you need to turn this into an actual soap opera, which is that this show needs to run a full year. We don't need to get into that here, but you notice it acutely in the show when it takes turns that are a result of, like, commercial pressures on the show that forced the creative team to, in a certain way, walk away. Although then they came back for the finale, right?
They come back for the final, like, three episodes, which are solid.
They did Firewalk, right?
Then Lynch did Firewalk, and then they both did The Return. And Mark Frost wrote books about the setting. Like, there are definitely all sorts of interesting.
He did all, like, the mythology building stuff that happened in, like, the periods between Twin Peaks.
And then Jennifer Lynch, David Lynch's daughter, wrote The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, which is fascinating. Huh. So,
When I was a kid, Twin Peaks and Northern Exposure were confused in my head, and that led to some really unfortunate viewings of stuff on the VCR. Anyway, we got to take a little break here to pay some bills and to propagandize you, of course, with messages that everything is fine. Everything is good. Consume. Consume. Consume.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay, so Patrick, we've been talking about weird shit and implied violence and abuse for a little while here. I don't think the thing you brought this week is as metaphorical or subtle.
What the fuck did you make us watch last night?
Mandy. Mandy is what you watched. Yeah, it's the new film from Panos Cosmatos. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Or if the interview I looked up where they introduced him, you pronounced his name wrong, and it's not on me. It's the second film. So I did a little research before. Panos Cosmatos is the son of George Cosmatos, who directed Tombstone, and then also directed a bunch of other films like Rambo Part 2 and Leviathan and Cobra, a lot of 80s staples. If you went to your local Blockbuster and went down the 80s rack, like those were a lot of films you would find. And this is his second film. The film he made before this 8 years ago, Beyond the Black Rainbow. Panos comes out of both Mandy and Beyond the Black Rainbow are come out of a genre of horror that is very art housey, very influenced by like 70s, like Suspiria, like in which aesthetic is often more important than plot or characters or anything else. Like they're often more mood pieces, in which like the soundtracks, the visuals drive their own narrative rather than like the actual motivations or like what's being depicted in terms of plot and characterization. His first movie, Beyond the Black Rainbow, is, I struggle with, like, as someone who loves horror, I struggle with enjoying a lot of like 60s and 70s cinema. I find it to often be a chore that like art house horror is not something that always works for me. I respect movies like Suspiria. I would not say I liked Suspiria other than sort of respecting what it accomplished and sort of what it represents as like Italian horror. And Beyond the Black Rainbow is like very much in that vein. It is extremely slow. It is extremely aesthetic in a way that when I saw it, I was like, cool. This was not for me, but I sort of enjoyed what it was trying to do, I guess. Or at least that's what I would tell my friends who really like that movie and I don't want to feel weird and left out. I think Mandy is a far more approachable film. It sort of splits the difference in a lot of ways. It is, in a lot of ways, very traditional horror, and it is, in a lot of ways, very art house horror. The setup is there's this couple in the woods. They are very sort of like removed from society. There is Mandy and Nicolas Cage's character. Do they even say his name? I don't know if his character is actually
Red. It's like Red Miller or something like that.
Yeah, they say Red like at one point.
Okay.
I just want to say really briefly, people should watch the trailer for this at the very least. Like, pause the podcast, watch the trailer, and come back, because it is worth internalizing what the aesthetic and the sound of what this movie is.
The trailer, the movie is just like a longer version of that trailer. Like, you'll get a lot of what Mandy is, even if you decide it's not like for you, from that, like, 2.5 minute trailer. It is really, the trailer itself is like really worth watching and conveys a lot of the, what the movie is going for. And yeah, so it's this couple in the woods, and the movie spends, part of what I really like about it is it spends like the first 30 minutes, like really just setting up, like not much happens in the first 30 minutes, but actually a lot happens. Like it sets up characters, it sets up a relationship, it sets up like personal stakes between these two. They are very separated from society. They don't bother other people. They are sort of on their own, and they love that. Like they have a very loving, caring relationship. Like there's a moment early on where Nicolas Cage, who, you know, he's a laborer that is like out like chopping down trees, and like there's a moment on the helicopter as they're going away from like the job site where someone offers him a beer to be social, and he just kind of politely turns it down and he heads back home to be with his significant other. Like these people are very happy. They've sort of like rejected certain parts of society, and like they have found a life for themselves in the middle of the woods, all on their own.
She's like a dope fantasy artist, and
yeah.
works at
wears
a
lot of heavy metal
store.
Shirts. Wears yes. like, reads it's a lot a, of.
It's a period piece of a sort. It's a yeah. It takes place in 1983, right? So lots of metal shirts, lots of like metal fashion, lots of like tight jeans and cut off shirts, 80s and band
sci-fi.
Shirts, 80s stuff, and 80s sci-fi fantasy, sword and sorcery,
yeah.
Aesthetics throughout the entire film. But like she loves that. Like
yeah.
that
she's
is
like reading. What's her name? She's reading.
She's reading like a very poor.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna fuck this up, and it'll be like we're not gonna get it. It's also, I think it's a period piece, but like where a lot of period pieces, I think about the '80s are like, oh, whoa, look at the '80s neon. Like,
yes.
what's the new cultural thing happening in the '80s? This is a period piece in the way it felt in the early '80s. Looking back on the way the '70s ended,
100%.
Right? It's all about like if the '70s is where it starts to feel like the unraveling is beginning. And I mean, this movie's explicitly about like this couple who sort of run away from society. They are found by murderous cultists, basically. And what sets
children
everything in motion is that a creepy
children. Yes.
What sets everything in motion is that a creepy religious cultist also apparently has like a line on summoning demon bikers, but we'll get to that.
We'll get there.
But this is about like this idea that. It's the early 80s, but it feels like in the last few years, something has gone badly wrong with the world and with America. And like spirituality has become twisted and tainted even. Like people who've gone mm-hmm. forth and like seeking faith. What they're seeking, what they find isn't faith, isn't spirituality. What they find is entitlement and darkness and nihilism.
Personal salvation. Like just like protecting yourself is the only goal. It's not about betterment of the world or your connections to other people. It's about, oh, am I going to get saved?
It opens with that Reagan talk, right? It's not the Morning in America talk.
Is that Reagan?
Yeah.
The headphones
thing? Spirituality
on the radio.
He flips off the radio.
He's like, fuck off, Ronald Reagan. 100%. Pretty sure that was Ronald Reagan. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe I'm wrong.
I'm pretty sure it was too.
Yeah, I thought that's definitely.
If it wasn't an exact. It was a sound alike. It was meant to evoke the Reagan and you know the anti hippie.
And the rise of the American evangelical
purity
movement.
Purity,
the Grahams, the Bennetts.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. exactly.
I was also so the thing is though, from the pictures, from everything that I'd seen and heard beforehand, and then I was talking with Natalie last night. I was expecting this to be a really rough movie, and it is, but not in the like. So me, the thing I have trouble with is, I don't know, just like really nightmarish gore fests are not my thing, and I was worried that's what this was going to be. But that's
Rob.
It's no, I'm relieved. I was able to watch it, right? I was like, because the thing I'd seen repeatedly was like Nick Cage literally bathed in blood. And I was like, that's probably not going to be for me. and the movie unfolds a lot more slowly than you're going to expect. But I think the thing I was not prepared for was how beautiful this movie was and how like not only she illustrates these covers and she creates this art. Mandy creates this art inspired by these fantasy and sci-fi novels and metal albums for sure. But watching it, I was struck by how often this movie was like the pastoral version of that type of art, if that makes sense. Like, it's all hyper saturated. The colors almost seem to like pulsate and throb in the frame. There's all sorts of little camera tricks, right? Like lens flares and like chromatic aberration. Like everything is like vibrating and bursting with like color and life and potency. And that was not the movie I was expecting. I was not expecting a movie that was going to be as interested in the way like the sun rising over the trees looks as Mandy is.
Yeah, I mean, this is like very, this is a movie that if you were to put it on a VHS tape and just put it up from actually 1983, it would fit in very well. Like the trademark of like late 70s, you know, like basically like early 80s and then like before that is like long shots. And it's not like long tracking shots. It's just like modern horror is obsessed with the cutaway. It is the jump cut. It is speed. It is efficiency. And one of the hallmarks of Panos Cosmatos movies and just like movies of this era in general are just like long shots that linger on both beauty and ugliness and emotion and terror. I mean, there's the, you know, without getting into sort of like the what actually happens in this, like there's a film where something horrible is happening in front of Nicolas Cage. He is tied up and the film goes silent except for the soundtrack. You don't hear the actual horror that's happening in front of him. You just have a quiet, eerie soundtrack that is slowly zooming in on his face for such an uncomfortable period of time. It is not 2 seconds. It's not 5 seconds. It's not 30 seconds. It's like several minutes of just focusing in on his face in which he's not screaming. Because most if you made this movie with modern cinematics, you'd be cutting in between the thing that's happening in front of him and you'd be cutting back to him. He'd be screaming at the top of his lungs. There'd be loud shrieking violins playing to a crescendo. And instead, like, this movie lingers in a way because it wants you to sort of just like be in this world. Twin Peaks was like an appropriate like topic to talk about before this, because this movie is very ephemeral. It is very, it's not nearly as mysterious as Twin Peaks, but it does feel often like the movie has an undercurrent both of like the culture and counterculture and drug culture. But the movie feels very much like a hallucination in which you are not meant to fully grasp like whether what's happening in front of you is reality or surreality. And like the way it plays with that, both in imagery and in plot, and the events that take place, like I found to be like you kind of just have to let go and just go with the movie in a way that I found like deeply compelling, and even more so upon a rewatch where I already knew what I was expecting. And I think the movie actually works even better upon a rewatch because you're less on the edge of your seat over like, well, what's going to happen? You know, especially if you're worried about the violence or the horror around the corner, like you can more better just kind of linger in the moment, because there are some truly masterful and beautiful shots in this film that like I found myself rewinding and rewatching just because they were sort of wonders to take in.
Yeah, I rewatched not on purpose, but I rewatched like the first 20 minutes of the movie like several times because it kept getting interrupted. and I found that it was just so interesting to me to take in that movie without having to like know what happened, and that's like kind of what you're saying about like the like Twin Peaks is a good partner to this, because when I was watching that movie, like the reasons why things were happening wasn't as compelling as like the literal coming together of the movie itself, like the literal visuals, the sound, everything like that. That is what was compelling me forward and keeping me through the movie, is not to figure out, you know, what is exactly going bump in the night. It's like, okay, like these visuals are just so cool and I want to keep watching them. But yeah, I don't know. I don't want to spoil.
I think there's stuff to talk about that isn't necessarily spoilers, but I do want to maybe address directly. Okay. Because I think there are things that just like stand out.
Yeah.
And are like, one of my favorite things about this movie is the way in which it moves almost effortlessly between aesthetic modes. It has such a long, slow intro, as Patrick says. And then it breaks those up with two different things, I think. One, clear references to a sort of horror kind of formula. There's a sequence where Nicolas Cage goes to Bill Dukes, who's a classic Hollywood like action and horror actor, to retrieve a crossbow. That is just like, he goes into this old trailer. They have an exchange that references some past and some history. Mm-hmm. And that style of event happens a couple of times in the movie, where there's just like, okay, I see. Okay, we're in a weird bad 70s horror movie. You know, like that is the vibe. But the other thing it does is it breaks it up with, or I think another one of those things is just like, is humor it uses. There are moments that are just devastatingly funny. The cheddar goblin sequence.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Just like fake TV commercial. I think it's a fake. It has to be a fake TV commercial.
But it's just real enough, and then just odd enough where you're like, wait, what's going on?
So the Noid was real. So like, right, Cheddar exactly. Goblin is like, exactly. Remember how fucked up advertising was in this era? But even the way that's used is like,
right,
life goes on. Like, you're like, the way that is deployed is the suddenly like snapping back to normalcy, but normal's right. never well, normal. That is it. It's never as normal as it looks.
Well, and then you get the bathroom scene, which to me is like the height of that movie.
It's like the scene of the movie.
It's so like, good.
It's where Nicolas Cage, who is all over the
collects
place as an
his
actor.
Check. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, like, he's such an all, like, Nicolas Cage is as good as you'll ask him to be. I think is like what modern Nicolas Cage is. Like, if you give him a good script and if you give him like good direction, he can do tremendous things. And the bathroom scene in this movie is, I mean, it's truly, I watched it like 4 or 5 times, like, because there are so many subtle things happening in this moment. It communicates so much about like loss and despair and exhaustion and just anger in the course of, like, I don't know, 90 seconds or however long that scene goes on, that is both like touching and like it communicates so much with doing so little, that it's just, it's truly evocative in a way that the contrast with like the way the movie sets up like really tremendous like visuals, you know, with like red lighting in the background of the woods, and that lights up these Cenobite Hellraiser looking creatures.
That is what they are. They are Cenobite bikers. They're Cenobikers. It's amazing.
Yeah. And that whole scene with the lighting is like both terrifying and without actually being like tremendously violent. It's good. But that bathroom scene, like, it, anyone that is, I mean, we've all experienced loss in different ways, but like tremendous, excruciating, confusing loss. Like, I didn't have a moment like that after my dad passed, but if you were to condense like 2 years after my life into like a 90 second moment, like that bathroom scene, like, I sat there going like, yeah, dude, I fucking get it.
It's like all of the magic is gone. All of the saturated colors disappear, and you're left with this like grimy 70s wallpaper that's like brown and yellow.
It's like the flower. It's like weird.
It's like
flower
a floral
design.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And like an old cabinet where he finds like some old alcohol, some like old moonshine or rubbing alcohol. Who could say what he's drinking in that sequence?
He doesn't seem to be enjoying it. He has to at some point like massage his throat so he can keep chugging it.
Yeah.
That moment after the thing that divides this movie happens, and there's a cut, and the cultists leave. And when after the cut, that moment where you're right, the colors, the filter, everything has changed. All the magic is gone. Now it is just like dismal, flatly lit reality that you're snapped back to, is so good. The other thing I want to call out here is, I think the thing that holds a lot of this movie together, and that allows it to have this pacing where it unfolds in a series of like thematic arcs almost, John Johansson's score is I think the MVP of this movie in a lot of ways, because I think it is doing,
unfortunately, his last
a lot
he
of
he died lifting. Just before this movie came out.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Do you want to describe it a little bit for people who maybe you haven't heard it?
But it's tough to describe. Like, it's difficult for me to describe like ambient Prague. You know what I mean? Like,
that's right. It. You got it. Ambient Prague.
No, that's right. Because basically what Rob's getting at is that, like, yes, like, it is synthy in the way so much like horror thriller films like relied on synth based music, but it's not. But it's not John Carpenter, right? Like, it's not do-do-do-do-do-do. Like, it has moments where it is thematic and builds in a traditional score way, but otherwise, it's just sort of ethereally there. Like, it's just, it's its own character, I guess, is part of what I'd say. Like, especially relative to modern horror, in which music is just meant to punctuate moments, like a jump scare or something like that. Like, the music is irrelevant. Like, the music in this film is a character all its own, in a way that is given a sensitivity and attention that feels equal to Nicolas Cage or like the lighting. Like it is a central tenet in a way that, like, you're absolutely right, Rob, it stitches a lot of the film together because it leans so heavily on the score to even work foundationally.
Yeah, I definitely, like, there is something about it that is transportive, but also it's not just, it isn't just, oh, right, it's the 80s, synth is hot. Like, it is not that at all. The same instrumentation is used throughout it to be kind of to set a very romantic mood and also to, like, be the center of Nicolas Cage's rage, to be a sort of, there are moments at which, and I there's a key sequence in which, again, the score is broken and replaced with the corniest song I've ever heard in my life, in which a character reveals that he used to be a musician.
Oh my god.
That scene doesn't work without the rest of the score being just, like, so overwhelmingly, like, emotive and real and, like, it's under my skin in this such a good way.
Yeah.
And then it's like the worst '60s. Yeah. Like, yeah. That sequence is amazing for a lot of reasons. And I think one of them is, and I think we have to at least touch on the fact that, you know, during the Twin Peaks conversation, we talked about the, like, violence against women in Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a film in which violence is done against the character Mandy. And I think for a lot of, for me, I went in very worried that it would end up being a sort of torture porn or, like, that it would really over-aestheticize violence done to this character. Like, I know it's a revenge movie. I'm not going to talk about what happens specifically this way or that way. I think the movie throughout most of it is pretty ambiguous and is not it is not a film where, like, I know what's going to happen. And so I want to maintain some of that.
Yeah.
But I will say that there are sequences of not just, like, not direct violence, but of, like, torment and emotional attack. Mm-hmm. And the way she is written as an agent in those sequences was really important for me as a viewer because it maintained her perspective and her character instead of reducing her to, like, a pawn in a larger story, if that makes sense.
Where she's just the premise for a revenge
fantasy
for a bunch of violent sequences that someone said, wouldn't that be cool to see happen? Like, that, without the laughing scene.
That's the one I'm talking about.
Incredibly powerful. The build up to that, the way it's shot, the way two characters' faces are layered over one another during a certain sequence is, like, that laughing scene is so uncomfortable and so empowering that for whatever, you know, happens next, it says so much about her, that, like, that laughter lingers throughout the entire, it just permeates the whole film afterwards.
Right.
Because everything that drives Cage's actions are driven by that laughter,
and
that says about her, what that says about, like, what she meant to him, like, it just, it's such an important moment in the film
about, like, what they share, like, it's like that laughter is absolutely shared. It, like, definitely transfers over because there is humor. Like, he is also laughing in the face of, like, you know, during these bouts of rage, during these like encounters, like, there is, like, like you said, Patrick, like, that laughter echoes throughout the whole movie.
It's just like, you pathetic fucks.
Yeah.
Like, you completely shitty little tiny people.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Which is, it is really cool to see the enemy. It isn't like, I don't know, I don't want to spoil anything.
Yeah. People should see the movie. I will say there is gore in this. Like, we kind of talked about how, like, oh, it's not torture porn. Or Rob, you said, like, you were afraid it would be this hyper-violent thing. There are moments of hyper-violence.
Yeah.
There's moments of hyper-violence, but it's not if on one spectrum there is the hostiles of the world in which when someone's, like, the back of their foot is cut, the movie puts the shot down and you see, like, the knife go through the tendons in the back of their foot.
Fuck that.
Yeah.
This movie is not that. It is also it feels responsible with its violence. The violence is meant to convey something. Like, there are horror movies, and I watch lots of them that are just, when I watch Friday the 13th, I just want to see creative, fucked up, weird things. I like to laugh at death. Like, this movie deploys that to some degree, but its violence is, like, meant as a creative expression of, like, the character's rage.
It's more, like, graphic novel-y, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
Like,
yeah.
And that's actually something I was thinking about with Twin Peaks, too, is, like, it feels very graphic novel-y in the way that, like, certain sounds are accented that you wouldn't necessarily, like, feel, like, notice that they are being accented unless you were reading them and then they were accented for you.
Snap or whatever.
Snap, right? Yeah, whatever, yeah. Like, crackle or, like...
Pop. Those are the three sounds. Snap, crackle, and pop.
God damn it. Okay.
I'll just leave it this quote when I was reading this interview with Panos Cosmatos, where he said... someone asked, like, where did this project come from? And he said, I started writing Mandy at the same time I was writing Black Rainbow, which would be around a decade ago, after the death of my father, which was sort of compounded on top of the death of my mother, which I had sublimated and completely suppressed and not dealt with. I realized that I had to face these things and cope with them or it was going to eat me alive. It wasn't on purpose, but I realized in retrospect that they're both articulating two separate parts of the same thing. Black Rainbow deals with a lot of control. It's an expression of how I was pushing in my emotions and felt trapped. Then Mandy is the opposite of that. The movie's a very emotional outward expression of those feelings. I've said that Black Rainbow is like an inhale and Mandy is an exhale. I became obsessed with the revenge genre around that time because it can be a very cathartic genre. I wanted to make a revenge movie that centered around the person in a way that was being avenged as much as the Avenger. And I think that speaks to that laughing scene. It speaks to, like, Cage's motivations. Like, this movie tries to not forget the person who was hurt, even though that motivates the plot that goes forward. So I think as far as these types of movies go, I think it's a very thoughtful one. And I think can potentially be enjoyed by folks that don't necessarily find themselves enjoying horror films.
I want to amplify that because this is, like, on the surface, judging it by its cover, this is the sort of movie that I tend to go out of my way to avoid. Like, I would never have picked this out ever to just, like, watch on, like, on my own. And I'm extremely glad I did. Like, it's a wonderful experience, and it is not the thing you're afraid it's going to be. Heartily endorsed and definitely surprising.
One thing I'm realizing halfway through this, or three-fourths of this podcast, is that one thing we should do in each of the segments is, like, tell people where they could, like, go.
Good. That's a good idea.
So we'll do these in show notes. We can do it at the end as well. I'll just say that with Mandy, it's playing select in theaters, but it is also available on video on demand, iTunes, you know, basically anywhere else you can
rent. Which is a really cool way of doing this, like, art house horror film that probably would not do great if it was just super widely distributed and had to, like, go up against autumn movies. Like, no, like, it's available. If you're in if you're in the middle of nowhere and you don't have, like, a theater that gets movies like this, you can get it online immediately.
Cool.
You don't have to wait 6 months.
And then it'll be on Blu-ray next month, and I will buy this movie on Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it'll look great.
Yeah.
I don't own many movies, but I want to
this
own
is a high this is a movie that will reward, I think, like, a high fidelity viewing.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I realized just now that I should disclose that I am online friendly with the co-screenwriter, Aaron Stewart-Ahn, who co-screen wrote this with Cosmatos. Also, you should follow Aaron on Twitter. He's at some bad ideas. We don't go out for beers or anything. He came to one of my talks once, which was very nice of him. But, like, we've been internet friends for long enough that it's like I should say, hey, heads up, I'm biased.
We're internet friends.
I've been rooting for this dude. I think this movie is fucking great regardless and probably would anyway. But disclosed.
You know, I don't think in the future on this show we should disguise humble brags as disclosures.
Okay, well,
no, they should be called humble brags. They're not disclosures.
Can I do another humble brag?
No.
Sure.
I just want to humble brag about another person who I'm friends with who's been doing a really good job promoting a different media franchise.
That's called a pivot.
Danica Herod's The Dragon Prince. Herod? What is it?
I've already forgotten.
I believe it's Herod's.
Herod's. Like the British store.
Like the store.
Okay. That is my segment for today, is I watched all of The Dragon Prince, which is a Netflix original cartoon that was made by, I guess, like, the lead creators on it were Aaron Ehaz and Justin Richmond. the name of the production company is Wonderstorm. As always, there are a lot of people who work there. There's like a lot of great writers and directors who worked on it. It is a – in some ways, I think it's already being framed as a follow-up or a successor to Avatar The Last Airbender and Korra, largely because there's lots of the similar talent involved.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the writers and some of the directors have done – did work on those series. And it is a fantasy show kind of in like the YA space or like the – you might call it like a middle grade if you were talking about fiction story about the – it's about a trio of kids who are trying to intercede and stop an impending war between the humans and the elves, between like kind of the world of humans, the kind of like down, the dirty, the like kind of dark and mundane world of humans, and this super magical world of elves and dragons, and you know the free flowing of mystical energies. And I think that one of the most interesting things. There's a couple of really interesting things for the show. I think it does a lot of things that just cartoons have gotten good at doing in the last decade, last 15 – American cartoons have gotten good at doing, yeah. Let's say, in the last 10, 15 years around having episodes that are about something without being heavy-handed, mm-hmm. without being didactic. You can have an episode that is about stereotype or an episode that is about making sure you keep your promises or not making promises too lightly, stuff like that, without it being this like – and that's the lesson. And you know, the more you know, knowing is half the battle, right? It can just kind of like very character – in a character-driven way, can communicate that. But the other thing it does really well is it historicizes conflict in a way that is particular, that is about – how we got to here. And the Avatar I saw also did that very well. It gave the kind of big actors history. And so here, I think one of the real – not the real stars of the show, but the characters who kept me coming back were some of the characters who had been around in the world from the very – from not the very mm-hmm. beginning, but whose actions had led to the core conflict. Mm-hmm. So on the human side of things, which is like where the camera is focused, the major players are the two princes of this one kingdom. There's like five human kingdoms. We're kind of focused on one of them for this season, and it's Callum and Ezrin, who are kind of like a teen and then like a preteen, right? Mm-hmm. They're half brothers, and their father is the king.
Hot.
He's hot. His father is hot, and so is their father's hot, evil wizard.
Very ex. Hot.
I think they're exes. That's my read on this, 100%. And those are the characters who I think I kept coming back for. King Harrow, who is this, like, dope, like, buff, smart, black dude with dreads.
Oh, you mean Hero.
Right. Sorry, like the British... Yeah. Like the British convenience department
definitely
store.
Not a convenience store.
And his chief wizard, his chief warlock.
I think he's a vizier. Mage. Let's be real.
He's a vizier. He's a vizier. Let's say, you're right. He's a vizier. Whose name I'm completely blanking. Viren. Strong name. Mm-hmm. Truly.
Also hot.
One of the things that I love about the show is that over the course of its season, obviously the kids are going on adventures. The long and short is they're trying to bring a MacGuffin to a place to try to be like, hey, we don't have to have a war. We have the MacGuffin.
Mm-hmm.
But what we get bit by bit is this like allusion to the history that got them there to begin with. And it arrives very organically. There's some good fights along the way. So.
I think the thing that I really adore here is that, like, the degree to which this show is about power and the way people use it and yeah. what they derive it from. And I think something I'm really appreciative of here is that I think there's definitely a place for your cartoonishly, like, just purely unredeemably evil characters, like Azula in... Avatar, right? Where somebody's like mm-hmm. primary motivation is just like raw power and cruelty. But in The Dragon Prince, like The Dragon Prince makes you sympathetic to people that maybe you shouldn't even be as sympathetic to as you are. Like, I think like Viren is definitely somebody who you can like watch like sliding deeper and deeper into evil, like almost by episode by episode. Yes. And it's really compelling to watch because, like, at no point is he ever – he's a good guy in the way we live in a world governed by good guys who do bad, bad things, right? Like, loves his kids. Like, loves them. Like, really, like, makes time, like, mentors them. Like, great family man, good friend. But here's the thing. Everything he does is, like, in the service of maybe increasingly unholy ends, right? But even – Harrow, who I think we're meant to really sympathize with and like, he's sort of your good, your classic, like, there's the good king. But like you were talking about, Austin, we're picking this up at a moment where, like, the bill is coming due for stuff that he is allowed to sort of fester on his watch. Like, the first episode has this wonderful feeling of impending doom. Because from the first, like, is Harrow going to get murdered by the end of that episode? The elvish assassins are on his case, and they never miss their mark. And they're there. He knows what he did to bring them to his door.
And they've done that cool, like duty binding where they, like, have these bands they tie to themselves that's like, all right, this doesn't come off until we get the job done. And they always get the job done. It's extremely good. But I think you actually made the great comparison with Harrow to me that you read him as an Obama-like figure in that he at once inherited a sort of long-standing war and lots of issues with the state as it stands that he can identify, and he's in the place to be like, yeah, we've been fucking up for a long time. In the way in which he is good-hearted in terms of the way he deals with his children. He loves his children a great deal. He is certainly, I think, the sort of person who keeps people around him who disagree with him in order to, like, he believes in that spirit of debate, but also continues to perpetrate the same things that he can identify as being problems. There was a sequence pretty early on in which he basically says, like, if only it were so simple as I couldn't end this thing. And as the show continues, it begins to feel more and more like the reason he can't do that is because of the people he keeps around him and because he does not have the will to take large-scale action, large-scale dramatic revolutionary action, and instead is just, like, more comfortable keeping things better for people but not changing them in a way that, like, could risk overthrowing the way things are currently set up.
Mm-hmm. The implied, like, oh, if only we could end things. It's always end things without costing us anything. That's really the central, like, dispute here is that what's revealed. Somebody wrote in, actually, and I should take them up. I'm not going to get their name. I'm sorry. Somebody wrote in expressing some frustration with there's a way this can be read as being a technologically skeptical show that. What's laid out in the sort of opening sequence, the exposition, is that what the humans discovered is that in addition to the six natural forms of magic, there's dark magic. And dark magic is won by basically pulling life force out of other things. You're taking natural magic, natural power out of the world and using it for yourself. And there's a way you can interpret that as being like a technologically skeptical argument. And I think there's certainly.
I think sometimes you should make technologically skeptical arguments. Like, there is a place in the world for that.
Right.
There are technologies I wish we hadn't discovered.
Well, the person writing in was more like they were seeing a parallel between, like, anti-vaxxer movements as well. Like, skeptical, like, sort of a reflexive anti-progress, anti-science position.
Yeah, but I think, what is progress, et cetera, et cetera. We've had this conversation.
This is the thing, is, like, the dispute everyone has with the humans isn't, oh, you humans are just naturally evil. It's that you are enriching yourselves and empowering yourselves by leeching magic out of the world from other sources. You are throwing the world out of balance. And that's literally, like, that's the nightmare. That's the ecological nightmare in which we are increasingly finding ourselves mired and doomed. And that's kind
of... And also...
Go on.
And also the ethical nightmare, I was going to say, which is, I think, what you were pointing to, Austin, about, you know, why are we, like, we are going ahead with things that we don't know, we aren't at the same time doing, we are not doing developments on the ethics of technology at the same time that we're doing the developments on the actual technologies themselves. And that is extremely terrifying and dangerous.
Right, like Viren and all of the Viren has a daughter in this show who is fantastic. Claudia, is that the name? Yeah. Both of whom are these brilliant mages. I love how magic is done in this world also. It's like super physical. Like I can imagine going into this show as a creator and be like, all right, this can never look like Avatar. This should never just feel like the way magic works is that people use their will to shape the world. Mm-hmm. Or if that happens, that should distinctly not be a human style of magic. And so it's lots of like Three Eyes of Newt and like – it's like that style of – like alchemical magic.
Love that.
The combination of things and like just good handwork, just good like mixing things and like breaking, snapping like bones or whatever to do a thing. Like that stuff is all super good. But neither of them ever do the thing of like, there's no like suspicion of the paradigm. There's no, of course we just do dark magic and they both have this great bag of tricks. There's a running thing throughout the entire season where it turns out that because they don't have direct access to like natural magic, he's like, oh, just put it in a ball. Just carry the magic of air around with you all the time. And that's not a thing that's ever really questioned as like, is that chill? It's just powerful. Mm-hmm. It is just powerful. So of course we do it. And even in the kind of the narrator's version of history, you know, we have what I think is a disinterested narrator. We don't have – this isn't Harrow telling the story of humans and elves, right? Their story is one of greed. It is one that's like, hey, we discovered this and we jumped to using it so that we could take something as ours. Mm-hmm. And I was actually shocked that it went that far in being, nah, the humans fucked up. Period. The end. Like that is not a, that was not a cool thing to do. Discovering, you know, making nukes is, we're not going to tell the story. We're like, what if you use nukes for good? Like, no, they shouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
And that actually struck me in a way because I think a lot of children's cartoons end up doing the like, you got to hear both sides. Like, we don't want there to just be something that is that clear.
The other thing I want to shout out here is, on the one hand, and I think this is actually really well handled. This is an enormously inclusive and diverse show in a lot of ways. Like, right. A really – like a character that is already looks like they're going to become a fan favorite. Certainly one of my favorites is this General Amaya, mm-hmm. who is – I believe she's deaf. Yes, she is because she tells somebody not to look away from her when they're speaking. But she communicates in sign language and it's not translated, by the way. She has an interpreter with her right. who like in like. But when she's making a prayer before a like memorial to her sister, we don't like that is not interpreted for you. Like that is if you can read sign language, then what's happening is readily interpretable. But the show is really, I think, clever in how it. Presents her and how it represents her. And it's like that across the board. But it's also doing something else, which is that I think it is playing on the way we can sometimes view representation as being inherently positive and progressive, even maybe when it's not, if that makes sense. I think there's going to be a lot of people who are really won over by Viren's daughter Claudia.
Right.
You know, awesome, like, you know, girl power. Like, she can do anything. She's, you know, she's a brilliant, capable young woman. The fact that she's, like, she's allowed to be girlish, but it's never, like, communicated as, like, huh, she's still, you know, she's, what a ditz. It never does that. She's allowed to be a young woman and, like, have fun, but also it never uses that to cast doubt on her capability. But here's the other thing. Is Claudia maybe evil? Because I think she's maybe evil.
Or she will be. Right. That is definitely of the – one of the core things that the show sets up is very much like, hey, this mage has two children and this mage has like such a real politic pragmatist. I mean, there's literally a line where he's like –
one of the best lines in the fucking series.
I don't remember. It's like, I'm not evil.
Somebody says you're a monster and Viren just looks at him and goes, you're mistaken. I'm a pragmatist.
Right, like he's gonna get it done no matter
what.
Jason
Simpson, good voice acting on Viren, by the way.
Very good. Yeah, but yeah, like one of the things he puts into motion is very much like how much is he shaping his children to be him? And the answer, I suspect, will be very much. And I don't know, maybe in season two or season three, we get like Claudia and her brother like break away from their evil mage father, who could say. But I actually, my read is very much like yours, Rob. It feels like, you know, the sort of like cheering at the idea of there being a female CIA director and calling that progress.
Yeah.
Right? Or like, oh, wow, it's queering drone warfare. Like, that style yep. of, like, it's made a very cool woman character in a show that has other cool women characters, which is, I think, an important distinction, right? She is not the woman of action in this show, yeah. and therefore the sole representative of women. Rayla, who is this moon shadow elf assassin, is
so good.
Actually, I think, the protagonist of the show, and is also dope. So I think they have room with Claudia to have someone who. Right. We are kind of lured in with girl power and then hit with the sort of like cynical white feminism that's mm-hmm. like, yes, the
girls can be mean, too.
Exactly. And then like literally like girls can be the face of the powerful hegemony also.
Well,
like,
yeah.
Sick.
Like King Hera. It's a classic right. fantasy universe, but like the noble, strong king.
But there's
is
a cool
like
black king.
A black king who wears his hair in a natural style. Like, awesome. Also, he's perpetuated a generational warfare without end and has transgressed every boundary of international law and norms.
Of law.
Like, that's, yeah, that's kind of what the show is doing, and I kind of love it for it.
Totally. Yeah, I also think that's happening with one of the leads, Callum.
Oh, I hope my sweet baby boy doesn't go bad.
He sucks, Rob. Callum sucks. Callum is Kylo Ren, but without knowing who Darth Vader is. He's Kylo Ren, except instead of worshiping Darth Vader, he worships Harrow.
Except he
Obama.
Doesn't think he's special. That's
but he does, dude. His actions speak. He's like, he will tell you all season that he doesn't think he's that special, but he's the one who's going to make the call and decide what the plan is. He's the one who's going to step out and do a thing while literally he's surrounded by people who are smarter and more knowledgeable than him saying, hey, don't do that thing. He does it anyway. He's 100% a character who believes that you should ask for forgiveness instead of permission. And that's how he operates in life. And is thus far rewarded for it, but in a way that I think the show knows, because we do get the sidelong glance from Rayla. We occasionally get someone who is like, you're getting us into trouble again, and he does it again. And he's the primary motor, the engine of the show, because he's willing to do that. But it's going to, he at the very end of the season, without getting into specifics, he does a thing and it works out. But he doesn't do it with any consultation. He doesn't do it with any insight that it will work. And I think that his like soul, in a sense, will probably be, at the center of a conflict throughout the series. I suspect it'll be fine in the end. He'll find himself. But season
what
three,
a power
let me
move
tell
it
you,
would be if it's not fine in the end.
Especially with Claudia, right? Like, they're definitely going to have Claudia pull him away from Rayla. That is where this goes.
Yeah.
If I'm writing this story in 32 episodes from now, write it down. Like, Claudia brings him over to her side.
Got to have the Zuko back with the Fire Nation arc.
You got to do it. Anyway.
I think you're being a little unfair to Callum. That's a spoiler cast conversation for another day.
Yeah.
I
think he's a spoiled white boy. I 100% do. Like, I think that is how he is written.
I think the show shows him to be shitty. I think what's important is he also can be, like, he knows when he can be shitty and, like, does try to, like, do right by it. Like,
a lot of spoiled white boys do that, too.
That's true.
That's what I like about the show. It's like, there's a version of the show that I can't stand that is, like, just the very boilerplate version where he's just the guy who's always getting people into trouble and doesn't actually give a fuck. Like, the thing that I encounter in the world is lots of people who both tell me they care, who do care, and who, because of their privilege and because of their history, don't actually know how to help people unless it also helps them.
Mm-hmm.
They do not know how to kind of divest from ways in which they will gain also, which is like a core thing throughout this season, right? Is like, he can't just trust Rayla. He does not just want to give her the thing she wants. He needs something too. And I think there's a conversation there about trust and blah, 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 like that the show does want to have. But he can't bring himself to just do that until it is too late. So I don't know. It is good. I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah. Did the animation bother you?
Yeah. There are times when I think it works in effect. So the anime, it's a CG show that is like looks like a 2D show, mm-hmm. right? It's a show that is very clearly working on a more limited budget, I think, than something like Avatar. You know, the backgrounds have lots of static characters. There are lots of like static backdrops with active characters in the foreground. Mm-hmm. And the thing you're talking about is an animation style that is like very framey. You know, we sometimes get like one frame of animation a second, and sometimes it doesn't seem to make sense for why it's doing that. Like sometimes it's a sequence where like the animation needs to be really important and it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
And other times those like hyperactive action scenes are beautiful and like the animation is super flowing. But there are times when I think there's a sort of like comic book quality mm-hmm. to the way when it happens and it feels like a choice, but it is not consistent in any way. But I watched it and had a good time watching it because it's not really what I was there for. I think if it had been as inconsistent all the way through, it would have bummed me out more. But
yeah, I mean, for me, it didn't bother me that much. I kind of liked the way it is a show that unfolds in a series of like striking tableaus in a way. But I definitely think, certainly, particularly for some action sequences or like scenes where there's a lot of motion or dynamism, they're probably going to have to animate that a little differently than they did. Because there are moments where it's like a little stop motion-y in a show that generally doesn't look like that. But yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right. I think, and you can watch that on Netflix.
You watch that on Netflix, yes.
You can watch Twin Peaks on Netflix.
Awesome. Probably other places also, right?
Probably a lot of other places. Probably several other places.
It's on Hulu as well.
There you go.
There you go.
It used to only be on Hulu. That's where I watched it before the
return. And if you want those fascist postcards, go to Boston's Museum of Fine Art.
There you go.
And the Art of Influence exhibit. All right. So I think that will do it for Wednesday Waypoints. Our thanks.
The first ever.
First ever. We'll see how this format evolves and changes. We'll see if we expand the 2 minute hate. Just maybe next season of The Dragon Prince, just an entire episode just devoted to dragging Callum straight to hell. but for now, we're still using the Bowen track for this one right now, right?
We are still
using
the Bowen
track. We might
have
other music at some point, but
I would love to. Yeah.
All right, so our thanks to Bowen for letting us track. Our thanks to Bowen for letting us use his track, Miss You, off the EP Pale Machine. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney, and you can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people keep up with you online?
Follow me at Patrick Klepek.
Austin?
At Austin _ Walker.
Natalie?
At Natalie Watson.
Knew the baby voice was coming.
It's coming, Wob. Bye-bye, everyone.
Okay. Well, that'll do it for this week's Waypoints. We hope you've enjoyed the break. We'll be back again.
And remember, always eat your cereal with milk.
Yeah.
Milk. We'll be back next week. I'm just doing the outro to Three Moves Ahead. We'll be back again this week with Waypoint Radio. Hope you'll join us again. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
Damn.
Just gotta shout out my machine elf friends.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.